And we're back here on Unusual Sources 93.3 CFMU FM, first program of the year. And we're very lucky to have two distinguished guests with us today, doing some organizing and whatnot in Hamilton. And I just couldn't resist the chance to have them both in the studio today. We have Christopher Black, and he's an international lawyer who has a long and interesting career on these issues that we're going to be talking about today. And we have Professor Graham McQueen, and he was the director of the Center for Peace Studies right here at McMaster University. So it's familiar territory to both of you, I'm sure, but thanks very much for coming in today.
Well, you're welcome. It's good to be back at McMaster after all these years.
Great to be here, Brendan.
A lot of activists come from here, and you both of you have so much to contribute to this. We're talking about the article that both of you wrote and submitted. It got published in the Toronto Star. It's an op-ed piece in the Star. It's called "How Canada Can Lead North Korean Peace Talks at Vancouver Summit," and it's response to all this saber rattling and dangerous talk and action. And Canada has a role in negotiations, and you have a definite viewpoint on how things should be conducted, one that has attracted enough attention. I guess the first question here, I suppose I'd ask Graham, how did you manage to do this? I know you had a big role in getting this letter drafted and sent out. How did it come to your idea to be sending a letter to the Toronto Star on how Canada can take a more constructive role in the North Korea situation?
Well, some months ago, I decided to look into this North Korean crisis a little more, in a little more depth. I'd been concerned with war issues, of course, for decades, but I'm no Korea expert, and took a little urging for me to look into it. And when I looked into it, of course, I realized, as others have, that this is extremely dangerous, and also that we're getting another huge dose of propaganda, as is so common. I'm no Korea expert. I've been to South Korea, but absolutely not selling myself as that. But I know a fair bit about peace work, anti-war work, and I know a fair bit about foreign policy of the United States. So it's pretty clear what's going on. All the steps are being put in place one by one. You demonize your opponent. You try and get the UN on board. Donald Trump, I think, is too frankly out of it to realize the importance of that, but there are obviously people around him who do realize the importance of it and who are being very careful actually to build the blocks they need in order to be in a position to carry out a war of aggression against North Korea. So they've brought the Security Council along, they've got China and Russia to go with it. This is very dangerous. This is like a building of the coalition of the willing that we saw before the Iraq attacks. And as I saw this happening and knowing a bit about the Korean War and knowing that nuclear weapons could be at stake, I began to think, this is urgent. What can I do? Now, I write for various sites on the internet, but they're often read by people who think the way I do. And while it's certainly worth writing for them, I was desperate here to have something published in a mainstream organization or vehicle. And so Chris and I had talked about doing an op-ed, and it didn't take too long to draft this, to make it sufficiently moderate, you know, and cut out all my rhetoric and denunciations. And the Star actually jumped at it. Didn't take any persuading. They were looking for something. And so there it is.
I guess Trump's crazy talk on the issue has shaken a number of people. And at least people are making rhetoric about constructive solutions. And what you have to say is something that wakes you up, because unfortunately you've seen this script before. Both you and Christopher are quite familiar with the script of demonization and putting the blocks into place to attack a country, which we've all seen a number of times now in the last 15 or more years. Not just with reference to North Korea, but even presently with other countries. So, it's a big problem. And you are obviously responding to the inadequacy of reporting and coverage on North Korea. People can just say anything they want to about North Korea, and it's accepted as true, no matter how ridiculous it is, which is very dangerous. Mm-hmm. Christopher, I mean, you, unlike so many people who go on and spout off about North Korea, you've actually been there.
Right.
You've spoken with people there. You've seen parts of the country. I found that to be fascinating. I heard you give an interview on the Taylor Report, and I wanted to learn more because we do have some Canadians who have been to North Korea and have helped us out on this issue and contributed. What was your impressions and your experience when you were able to go there?
Well, I went with the National Lawyers Guild delegation from the United States of American Lawyers. I was the only Canadian on that trip. And we were invited by the Democratic Lawyers Association of North Korea. Now, people may find it surprising that they have lawyers in Korea with the propaganda that people hear in the mass media hear, and that these lawyers were all defense criminal lawyers, or criminal defense lawyers. Yes, they do have them, and they're very sophisticated people. We went there also with some trepidation because, although I'm on the left, two members were, one was a Republican, one was a Democrat, one was independent. We all had trepidations about what we would find there because even we had absorbed subconsciously or consciously some of the things being told to us in the mass media about that country. But our surprise began as soon as we got on the plane to go into Pyongyang from Beijing, because the plane was packed with people from Scotland, Germany, Turkey, Canada. There was a person going into North Korea to set up an electrified dairy farm sponsored by the Saskatchewan government. And when we got to our hotel the very first day we were there, the first people we met in our hotel were five American Army officers who had been there for 2 years. So it turned out that North Korea was not a hermit kingdom. It was not a locked-down, isolated kingdom or a country at all. It was many people were going in and out and probably still are, conducting normal commercial relations. And at that time, they had set up three free trade zones in Korea as an experiment. And we've asked these American soldiers, one was a major, what they were doing there. They were there from Hawaii to recover U.S. servicemen's remains killed in the Korean War. They'd been there for 2 years, and we asked them, this is our first day here, what's it like here? And they said, look, don't quote us, but everything we were told about this country is false. It's one of the nicest countries we've ever been in, and everybody's very nice to us here, and it's nothing you've heard is true. And we spent 2 weeks there and found out that to be the case, that the country is, A, beautiful physically, as South Korea is. The people are not starving. The people are very well dressed. They dress better than we do here because everybody, all the men dress in like Africans do, in crisp shirts and slacks, and the women are very well dressed. You don't see any armed police anywhere. As opposed, when I come back to Toronto, I see policemen with Glock pistols in North Korea. We didn't see one armed policeman anywhere, not even with a baton. And the city, Pyongyang, is a very modern, futuristic city. The houses are what reminded us of something you'd see in Portugal and Greece, sort of red-tiled cottages. And standards there of living are very high because education is free up to PhD level. Students are paid a stipend. Healthcare is free. Housing is completely free. Doctors and lawyers are paid less than mine workers. Physical workers are paid more than professionals. It's considered that they have more risks and have more heavy work, so they should be paid more. These sort of things were surprising to us. And their attitude towards the law was also surprising because at that time, they had no death penalty. It's since been restored for treason cases, but at that time they had no death penalty, whereas Canada still does for treason cases. And the longest sentence they had was 12 years for a first-degree murder. So all these stories about work camps and death camps and all that is just complete fabrications. So that was our impression. I can go on much longer and tell you many more things. But
well, you know, I mean, you know, it's clear on the one hand that people living in the North Korea, they have a lot of difficulties and challenges for sure. They're under sanctions. I know you want to talk about that. Their whole country was burned to the ground in the 1950s, you know, and they had to build it all, you know, being isolated relatively. They were part of a socialist bloc at the time, which then disappeared in the 90s. That was a rough time. But it is a place where people go about their normal business. Mm-hmm. And they have schools and hospitals and roads and teachers and right. zoos and parks and so on. And they're not looking for World War III, and they're not a bunch of mole people. You know, it's, you know, that, and that, you know, relates so much to what you and Graham are saying in the letter, in that there's a few things here, that the sanctions keep coming up because it relates so heavily to North Korean daily life, but also the fact that people in North Korea, they don't want war, and they want better relations with South Korea. And you noticed that as well. Just as they had U.S. military personnel in there looking over remains and bringing remains back and that sort of thing, there's been trains from South Korea to North Korea, and, you know, these things where they have, you know, these industrial projects together. Right. North Korea and South Korea have huge sections of the population that want to unify.
Yes. Yes. When I met with the government, they told me that their plan, or their proposal, which they've made several times over the past 20 years, is to unify both Koreas into one federal republic. And that they would, the South would keep its free enterprise system, they would keep their socialist system, and be unified, and the American occupation forces would leave, which would make Korea maybe a more powerful industrial country than Japan, which is, I think, what one of the things they fear. And that over time, they said probably we'd end up with some sort of mixed economy. But the Americans won't give us that because they won't do two things we asked for. A guarantee they won't attack us, one a document stating that, and a peace treaty. If we had those two documents, we don't need our weapons. We would get rid of our nuclear weapons, which are a waste of our resources. We don't need all these people in the army. Army officers who told me, Major Kim at Panmunjom told me he wanted to be a poet. His brother's a soccer player. His sister was a violin player. But they're all in the army. He said a lot of his friends are in the army when they'd rather be doing other things in life because they fear an attack. So they feel it's their public patriotic duty to do that.
Well, it's like the Taylor Report said, North Korea is full of real people, you know, with real ambitions and goals. Right. And it's full of artists and poets and so on. Yeah. And they have their own view on the world. They have art exhibits brought in from abroad and so on. And they want to be part of the world, but they don't want to surrender, you know, after all the difficulties they face. For those who have just tuned in, we're speaking with Christopher Black, an international lawyer, and we're speaking with Professor Emeritus Graham McQueen, both of whom have been doing great work in trying to raise awareness of the different options that we have, you know, to take a constructive role rather than a Trump button-pushing role with regard to North Korea. I mean, you talk about solutions in the article, and they pertain to the fact that the whole approach to the country is wrong. Graham, I mean, you know, you've got about four solutions that are proposed in the article, like a permanent peace treaty, recognizing, you know, valid security concerns. I'm going to talk to Chris about some of the stopping points, but, you know, in terms of building some kind of better option for Canadians and for Koreans overall, you know, what are you looking to do? Because you have so much experience in peace studies and peace building activities and the anti-war movement and so on. Who are you talking to, or what are you trying to do Canada-wide to give us alternatives on this whole situation?
Well, I think the most urgent thing from my point of view is to rebuild the anti-war movement in this country. Because, you know, me talking to an MP here or there isn't going to change things. But a social movement can sometimes change things. At the moment in Canada, there's no good alternative voice now for peace. When journalists can praise this Canadian diplomatic initiative that's taking place on January 16th, for the most part, naively. There have been a few good editorials about it. But for the most part, they're pretty naive about it. Oh, good, Canada's going to do something diplomatic. We'll look into it a little more deeply here. We're co-sponsoring that with the United States, the biggest foe of North Korea in the world. We're bringing countries to this conference that fought against and helped burn down North Korea in the Korean War. We're talking about one of the aims of this as getting rid of loopholes in the sanctions against North Korea and increasing the pressure on that country. And it really offends me that this is all being talked about as diplomatic. Now, mind you, it's always been the case in the Canadian government, the term diplomacy can mean all kinds of things. So in this case, it seems to mean how can we, in a nice, peaceful, friendly way, get together a bunch of people to do something nasty to North Korea? But where's the voice for peace? Let's not confuse what foreign affairs, you know, in this country calls diplomacy with a voice for genuine, lasting peace with dignity. And if we want that voice for peace and dignity, where are we going to find it? Well, we need a social movement, and the social movement is sleeping. And op-eds and, you know, articles here and talking here and having forums all over the country, you know, this is what's necessary. And, of course, I should also mention that I've been talking a lot to Michel Shostakovsky, the host of the Global Research website. He, in fact, was one who emailed me a few weeks ago and said, we need to do something to prevent nuclear war in North Korea. How can we get things going? And so, of course, we put on a local event here. Michel is giving two more talks, and we're all talking about how to organize.
Yes. In fact, we had that talk. The Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War helped organize that talk. Michel spoke and filled up the church downtown. It was good. You know, I mean, with no resistance to these kind of things happening, you come and he tours and gets a lot of attention, actually, for people that are concerned about this. So that was a positive development. And in fact, videos of that lecture, he was introduced by Eva Bartlett, and videos of that are available on the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, the website, which is hcsw.ca. It's just been revamped and is much more useful now. So people should check that out. But as you're saying, you know, people that look into this sort of thing know that Canada has often played a sneaky role diplomatically. We portray ourselves as peacekeepers and diplomats, but often that, even though they take an interlocutor role or whatever, it actually turns out to be doing stuff that the Americans can't get away with, mm-hmm. and using our intelligence services and embassies and diplomatic personnel to go and further, you know, infiltrate a country and do some underhanded things. So we have to keep an eye on what Canada's actually doing. We want it to be doing something constructive. And as you said, lazy kind of thinking predominates, where it's assumed that everything we're doing is good, everything Canada is doing is good, and things like sanctions are good. Chris, you know that about the sanctions and how it affects domestic politics and the situation in Korea itself, and how it is an obstacle to peace and mm-hmm. any sort of progress there. I mean, these sanctions, this is not a benign thing. I mean, this seems to have real effects on everyone there.
Well, as Graham pointed out in an article he wrote, which is a very good point, that the cutting of the oil supplies by almost 90% is almost exactly what they did to Japan in 1941, which led to the war in the Pacific. And we don't want that happening again. But why are they cutting the oil supplies at 90%? That's collective punishment on a people, not a government. Whatever faults you can allege against the DPRK, why should the bulk of the population suffer the results of that? But speaking of the sanctions themselves are illegal. The Security Council has no right, it's ultra vires of the Security Council to invoke sanctions, vote for sanctions against one of the members of the countries of the UN, when they're in violation of no international law, and the DPRK is in no violation of any law. They're alleged that they're building nuclear weapons in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Well, they're not a member of that treaty. They withdrew. And all the Security Council members who have themselves have nuclear weapons and test them on a regular basis are not fulfilling their obligations under that treaty to seek nuclear disarmament, as the Pope called for this week. So the sanctions will have a serious effect, and they're meant to either undermine the government in North Korea and cause a crisis for the government there and to try and bring them to their knees. And it will not happen. They're a very proud people, and they remember what the Americans and, Air Forces and all the UN forces did when they attacked North Korea in 1950-53. I can tell you some horrible stories we saw there evidence we saw there of what they did.
Oh, they're never going to forget what was done.
They'll never forget.
It colors their thinking so much, right. Reasonably so. Imagine if someone came to Canada and burned down literally 100% of the country. It just burned everything down and there's nothing left and you had to rebuild it all from scratch and there's millions dead, a good chunk of the whole country, you know, 20, 30% of the population killed. You would never forget. It would be in every movie from now until the end of time about how these bad people came and did this, right. You know, to us. The sanctions and the international law, that it's just what you and Graham were writing about. You said in the article in the Toronto Star, stop insulting North Korea, banish the term rogue state. And I want that, you know, that's a big issue here because all sorts of names are applied to North Korea, and one of them is rogue state, and it's always someone the U.S. doesn't like, right? You know, Saddam's Iraq or Noriega in Panama or God knows. It's always someone who the U.S. doesn't like. North Korea is not going around invading all sorts of UN members. It's staying within its borders. So it's in violation of only of arbitrary things for the most part that the United States has invented in its, you know, self-imposed hegemony. It's really the U.S. fits the definition of a rogue state. Even Chomsky has talked about that. So, I mean, you know, rogue state, I mean, that's a very biased label.
I just want to say a word about that. Yeah. There's a lot we could say here, but what strikes me is rogue state is one of the key terms in the global war on terror. And if you look at speeches George W. Bush gave, for example, he basically said, okay, the Soviet Union is gone. We don't have to worry about them anymore. That was before they started thinking Russia really was still going to be a major world power. No, we don't have to worry about them anymore. So there are two things we have to worry about. One is terrorists, which of course can mean anything, and the other is rogue states. And so you have to bear in mind that's the official enemy. And they can name anybody a rogue state that they want to. There's no formal definition of that I'm aware of. So you have to be always very careful when they're trying to put somebody in that box and realize that there's a whole context and a history here. And this is part of what I talked about is the building up, right, of pressure against North Korea. And remember that George W. Bush also named the so-called axis of evil. The term was David Frum's, but George W. Bush used it. And North Korea is part of that axis of evil, according to, you know, so you have North Korea and Iran and a bunch of other states. And North Koreans are sitting there watching the countries that were named the axis of evil being picked off one at a time.
Yes.
What do they conclude? They conclude, well, they're going to come after us next. And so they work very, very hard. And I've talked to North Korean diplomats. They said, our people sacrificed a great deal to build up this nuclear deterrent because we think it's the only thing that will keep us safe. And I want to say one more thing about that. Jimmy Carter, former president of the United States, came up with a very good article. It was either August or September. I think it was August of 2017. He said, based on over 20 hours of direct talks with North Korean government people, he had concluded the following, and he lays it out. One of them is they think we're going to attack them. And they need,
why.
You know, I wonder why. And they need assurances, and they want a treaty, and so on and so forth. Very reasonable, very succinct, no mysteries.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that this U.S.-led international order is self-selecting for states that can defend themselves. You know, you have to be ready to fight, you know, and that's forcing anyone that wants to have a state to be ready to fight. And that sort of gets, you know, I wanted to conclude with a little bit about the geopolitics of the situation. And Chris, you were alluding to that in terms of the sanctions and the desire for unification among North and South Koreans. I mean, this has gone on for too long. You know, it's a tired story, and it's embarrassing, really, that there is, a North and South Korea pointing guns at each other. They don't seem to want this. It seems that the crisis actor, the people that are causing the tension and crisis right now, is the United States, not North and South Korea. And that, like, their presence is exacerbating the situation.
Right. Right. The North Koreans, if the proposal was accepted, unification, then obviously the Americans have to leave. They don't want to leave because that gives them pressure on China and Russia further west. But that's the only stumbling block, is the occupation and the American refusal to give them a peace treaty and just a simple written guarantee that they won't attack them. I wouldn't trust that piece of paper myself. But the fact that the North Koreans say we've asked for that and they refuse to give it indicates that they are going to attack us. And the last time they attacked us, they destroyed the country and they killed millions of people, and we're not going to let it happen again. That's it. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to attack anybody. We can have peace tomorrow. And yes, we're wasting a lot of resources building nuclear weapons we could be putting into other things. I mean, we've got a wonderful society here. And if you go there, you'll see that it actually is. It's not a fantasy. How much better it could be if they didn't have to spend resources on building those weapons. And they don't want to be doing that. They want to one of the things in their symbol is not just a hammer and sickle. They have the artist brush. And that's a very important point about North Korea, that they've included the artist brush, the intellectuals, as an important part of the society. So they have lots of creative ideas they'd like to put into action if they had the resources available and not being shifted into the war.
It's amazing what they've been able to do with the limitations that, you know, under which they've been operating.
It would stun you to go there and see what they've done with the limitations they have.
You know, there are people that are looking at the situation and making similar conclusions. You know, it really is, you know, groups of self-interested people and conglomerates in the U.S. that are pushing for this destructive situation. And a lot of people, in Southeast Asia could really do without a large conflict there, which would be absolutely devastating to international trade, never mind all the other consequences. People don't seem to have an understanding of what would actually happen if there was a real major war, that even if it didn't have nuclear weapons, it would still be an utter disaster.
Right.
And that's, you know, it's contingent on us to prevent that and to play a constructive role. So I'm glad you've been consistent, both of you, in your work on this subject, that you do want to see Canada actually play a role towards peace rather than giving talk about how great Canada is and we're doing all this stuff. But, you know, our diplomats are just tailing the U.S. and fulfilling a sort of auxiliary function to the way the U.S. operates. And it's good that you were in the Toronto Star and people could see that different perspective. So the article is called How Canada Can Lead North Korean Peace Talks at Vancouver Summit. That's from a week ago today. And you have both been contributing to websites. I know, Christopher, they can find your work on the Near Eastern Outlook, I believe.
A New Eastern Outlook, yeah.
Journal-neo.org,
yeah,
right?
New Eastern Outlook, neo.com. You can find a lot of my writing there. Also on global research, but mainly there.
Yeah, because you do write about North Korea, and you write about international politics and so on. So people can always pick up those articles. And, you know, Graham, you have been involved helping out with global research and helping publicize tours and all sorts of things that are exciting. I think you said this article has been posted on global research?
Yes.
Okay, so people can actually find the article on the Global Research site, and they'll be able to find updates if there's going to be some kind of organizing or coalition building or something there, right?
Yeah. Yes, I believe that's true. Michelle Shostakovsky is giving a talk, I think, in Winnipeg on the 15th, Vancouver on the 16th, and I suspect he will keep posting things that will be helpful to Canadians who really want to see a movement built against war in East Asia.
And you are finding people in each city you go to that are interested.
Yes.
So that's, you know, a good sign.
Well, I think most Canadians see themselves as for peace. I think you ask any individual Canadian, they'll say that. And if they knew the facts about each situation in each region of the world, what the real facts were, instead of what's being put across to them by certain mass media journals, they would not support what certain governments are doing to promote war. I don't think Canadians would do that. I suppose that's why the lie is put out to justify these actions, so people are fooled. But we got to stop being fooled and find out what real facts are.
Yes. When it comes to North Korea, they get away with the most outrageous commentary, even compared to anyone else. There's jokes on the internet where they show a scale of how much the media will lie about an issue, and it goes from, you know, something like Iran or Cuba, all the way up to North Korea, in which the most outrageous fabrications are routinely tolerated. And I think there's a growing recognition that they've been sold a cartoon picture of the country, which is not helpful to ending conflict or having any sort of constructive solution. But you two have been doing very good, consistent work on this subject, and you have contributed a lot, and so we're very pleased you could be with us today. You're setting an example for how the rest of us could approach this issue across Canada, as well as here where you're working in Toronto and Hamilton and so on. So thanks very much for coming in, making the time to do this. I think there is a groundswell of people that are conscientious and honest people who are willing to do something in their community. So thanks again for being on the program with us today.
Thanks for having us.
It's an honor. Thank you.